left my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Well, I hit the roundy road, many kinds I met there. Many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out. There's so much left to know when I'm on the road to find out. Ooh.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. We had a little trouble this morning getting started here with our board, so forgive us for a couple of minutes there of dead air. Unspun tries to unravel the hypes and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth tellers, advocates, and activists from around the world. We are streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the listen button. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. You can also send me email at unspun@kkrn.org or follow me on Twitter at DougBennett15. My co-host today is Pamela Spoto. She is my friend and colleague of many years. She is also a professor of English at Chester College and a longtime peace and justice advocate. Pamela is a host of Late Night Poetry Jam here on KKRN. Late Night Poetry Jam airs the last Saturday of the month at 10 p.m. That's tonight. So tune into that. And I want to thank Pamela for co-hosting with me today. Thanks, Pamela.
And good morning, Doug, and thank you.
Well, always glad to have you on because you add another dimension to the show.
Oh, goody.
Thank you. Our guest on the phone is Kevin Alexander Gray. He is a civil rights organizer and author. His books include Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama, 2008. He also contributed to Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion, 2012, and Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence, in 2014. Counterpunch recently published his 2002 essay titled Soul Brother, Bill Clinton, and Black Americans. Counterpunch and the Progressive magazine regularly publish his articles. Among those articles are Why Black Voters Aren't Feeling the Burn and Soul Brother, or question again, Soul Brother, Bill Clinton, and Black Americans. Kevin Gray and his younger sister, Valerie, were among the first blacks to attend the local all-white elementary school in 1968. Since then, he has been involved in community organizing, working on a variety of issues ranging from racial politics, police violence, third world politics and relations, union organizing and workers' rights, grassroots political campaigns, marches, actions, and political events. Kevin Gray is currently organizing the Harriet Tubman Freedom House Project, which focuses on community-based political and cultural education. He's an organizer at the National Mobilization Committee Against Drug War, former managing and contributing editor of Black News in Columbia, now serves as a contributing writer to other minority newspapers in South Carolina. He served as a national board member of the American Civil Liberties Union for 4 years and is a past 8-term president of the South Carolina affiliate of the ACLU, advisory board member of DRC Net, a drug policy reform coalition. Well, let's welcome our guest, Kevin Alexander Gray. Kevin, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Sometimes I don't know when people start mentioning all that stuff. I'm like, who are they talking about? Who that guy is?
Yeah, you have been deeply involved for a long time in important issues, and we are honored to have you on with us. I let Pamela speak for herself. She can jump in whenever she wants, but she has been an advocate on many levels, and I used to be on the ACLU board in San Francisco and here locally where we live, working with the NAACP chairman at the time, trying to support local youths that were embattled quite literally with gang. If any two black people walk down the street, it's a gang where I live.
Well, you know, it's, the ACLU has changed a lot since the years of Ira Glasser, which is when I spent most of my time with the union. Here in South Carolina, back when I was president, it was more grassroots oriented, and you know, and so the presence isn't what it used to be. And I think a lot of that is youth and the internet and a different way of organizing that I, you know, that I'm critical of, because I think at some level, with all of it, be it the ACLU, be it Black Lives Matter, be it the NAACP, whatever organization, at this point in black progressive politics and black politics in general, there's a need for grassroots organizing, reconnecting with the people in the communities, having a politic of the community that's consistent with progressive values, and putting people in office that will advocate progressive values. And even when you're talking about what's happened with national politics and the southernization of American politics, with neoliberalism and neoconservatism, that basically comes from that Dixiecrat, southern, race-based politics. In order to fight that, to fight these state legislatures and to change these state legislatures, it's going to take more than tweets and Facebook posts and doing these events where you, you know, where you go out, you might block traffic or you might raise hell for the day, but you know, you still got to go into those meetings, you still got to go into those communities, you still have to go to court and change the way some of these lines are drawn. So it, you know, at, we are in need of real serious grassroots reconnection and grassroots organizing across the country.
I made the same observations a couple years ago. We had, and I don't know if this goes under the category of airing dirty laundry or not, but there was a big discussion here with the ACLU, and they did exactly what you're describing. They made the grassroots an extension of the body, the centralized body up at the top,
yep.
Where the other way around, it used to be the other way around, where grassroots had some power.
Well, the South Carolina was one of those renegade chapters that was fighting that kind of move with the national ACLU and, of course, the local laws. And I think when I left the organization, the national came in and took the organization over for a bit. But it's starting to pick up here a bit. We just hired a new director, I think, about 4 or 5 months ago, and she's doing outreach. So I'm hoping that's a change for the better and a change back to really reconnecting with people. And then, because, you know, in a state like South Carolina, you know, it's easy to get people who will always do the liberal, politically correct thing. But sometimes on the hard issues, defending people who we might not ordinarily be in a room with because we have to defend the principle. Or, you know, this idea of defending the rights of the accused, really taking on the drug war, really taking on police departments in a structural way. I went to the ACLU as the organization, my volunteer organization of choice, because they sued people. And in order to get people's attention, sometimes you got to make them spend money. So I'm hoping that's the direction of the union. And let's just keep our fingers crossed, as they say.
Yeah, that wasn't really the question I wanted to get into with you, because I wanted to talk about your view on President Obama. I remember when he came into office, many of us were really injected with large doses of what Guy McPherson calls hopium, and what Malcolm X calls Novocaine.
I wrote a piece for Counterpunch called "The Novocaine Presidency" that stuck around.
Yeah,
and of course I quoted Malcolm. And that's what it's been for a lot of liberals, a lot of the people that had that hope that somehow or another the empire would allow one person to change it, and the idea in the black community that there was going to be no criticism of Obama, only praise, and only him on the top of the fold every week on black newspapers, and just the good news instead of really challenging what he was doing, this idea of expanding empire, expanding the assassination program, drone warfare, TPP, the NSA, the list goes on. And then when you look at economics in the black community, it's been horrible under Obama. So, as I said, just like with the, you know, which is why I raised the ACLU issue when that came to mind, there needs to be a new level of organizing. And I live in South Carolina. I live in a black, traditional black community in the heart of the city. We have a little small enclave of working slash middle class blacks, and all around us is an ocean of poverty. And so we really have to reorganize to fight back, to make up the ground that we lost in the last 8 years.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Pamela Spoto, a local educator and advocate for peace and justice, is co-hosting. Our guest today is Kevin Alexander Gray, civil rights activist, author, and chronicler of Black Experience in America. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Please call in with your questions and comments. I think Pamela had a question for you.
I have so many questions, and you know, you have brought up all of these different topics, and they're all topics that are close to my heart. You know, in terms of the drug war, policing, drone warfare, the Palestinian issues. I mean, you're a prolific writer, and I really admire that. And I have one of your articles here in front of me, And in terms of Obama and Black America, one of your sentences here is, by any economic measure, the Black community is in a severe depression. And going back to the Novocaine, statement, I also remember Amiri Baraka in one of his poems saying, you know, go back to sleep, you know, heaven will be here soon. And it's kind of like putting off taking action. And I'm not sure how we can educate and get people really moving with these progressive values. And I'll use the police department, the policing as an example of that. So much has happened. So many killing of unarmed blacks and people of color. And yet the police have just kind of hunkered down. They have not changed that culture of policing as Norm Stamper had suggested. So, I mean, do you see us moving at the possibility of making these good changes that address poverty and drone warfare and policing and the NSA? It just seems like this huge wall is in front of us.
Well, I mean, I spoke at Brooklyn College a couple of weeks ago, and young folk were asking the same question. Mm-hmm. You know, it really starts out with people organizing in their communities. People aren't going to go out in mass, have with some kind of mass epiphany and take to the streets and demand change. And even if they did, that's not how change works. You still have to work the institutions. You have to go to the meetings. You have to change people's minds. And people are very confused, just like you see all these black folks supporting Hillary Clinton. And when you look at the history of Bill Clinton, well, it's just been a fraud. And so, you know, it takes the same kind of effort that we had in the 60s and 70s, where we put resources to the issue, where we educated people independent of corporate media, independent of the institutions like the churches that basically keep you locked down in place and keep you believing in the here and after. I mean, and then you have to challenge people in the community that are your friends when they say things that are inconsistent. You mentioned Amiri Baraka, and I remember back when, God bless the dead, but I remember when Mary was out there criticizing people who didn't support Barack Obama. I think he called us rascals. I said, you know what, brother? You know, Obama is a corporatist president. And yes, having a black president or person of color is a measure of progress. And having managed Jesse Jackson's campaign and working to clear the way to make that happen, I'm supportive of the idea of someone that's qualified well, maybe not use the word qualified, because all you have to do is be 35 and a citizen. But, you know, I support the idea of expanding the democracy, but, you know, expanding it with a neoliberal corporatist politician, which is the subject of this, the book I'm working on, The Decline of Black Politics, isn't out yet. And that's basically the working title. I think we've come to the title, The Rise of the Smoothie Doovies. the decline of black politics from Fannie Lou Hamer to Barack Obama, because Fannie Lou Hamer is where black folk and their participation in the modern Democratic Party really starts. And if you're talking about people like me in the South, it was Fannie Lou Hamer and this idea of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenging the establishment that created where we're at today to some degree, because a lot of it was the pushback on that. But, our politics can never stop. And it can, and when you're challenging a country that's basically an empire that has imperial inclinations, you still have to be critical of the person that's in office, and you still have to organize to promote your interests. As you mentioned, Pam, you have to understand the interconnectedness of the issues, and you have to build coalitions, and that's a difficult thing in these days and times when everybody believes that it's all about the internet, it's all about the most that we can get in the corporate media as far as liberalism is concerned is a MSNBC that will feed us neoliberal politics during the daytime, and on the weekend, a whole array of prison and lockup programs. So, it is a time for us to understand that there is real change that needs to be made, and just be, as this show does, just be truthful about what it is that's wrong with our reality in our country, and folk have to be willing to make the sacrifices to change it.
Yeah, Kevin, I was reminded this week, again, you were talking about people being confused. I think, yes, they're confused. The mainstream media, unfortunately, has contributed to that in so many ways. I could cite a couple instances. But I was reminded at a local meeting, because it brought it all home to me, that Americans in general don't even know their history. And we were talking about an issue of racism and genocide regarding Native Americans in this meeting of about 20 people. And I was just amazed, because they were defending expressions like red savages and knock the war paint off your face that was part of these expressions that we were giving airtime to, I guess I could say. And anyway, but they had no idea the historical value or what was going on, that we were responsible as Americans, and they didn't know their history. And I know you've spoken to this, and I just think it's so important, because if we don't understand who we've been, which has been a pretty murderous group all in all, how are you ever going to come back and unite people around real values of peace and justice and tolerance, and how can we get back there?
You know, I've been working on this piece since Prince died. I'm trying to get it out, and I've worked under various working titles, but my central theme is called The Ark. And of course, you think about Martin Luther King, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And I was thinking about people looking at Prince as a contemporary figure, as though he were an anomaly, as though he wasn't connected to a history, to a way of life. His father came from New Orleans, was a musician, and how that whole culture of New Orleans and what it infused in that man, it infused in his son. And when you think about Prince, you think about Sly Stone, you think about Jimi Hendrix. You can read the piece, the statements by Miles Davis, where Miles loved Prince because he saw Duke Ellington in him. And I think about, I'm 58, and Prince was 57, and we were the generation of mass desegregation. And so there's a whole history, and I'm thinking back to speaking to the kids at Brooklyn, there's a whole history the last 30, 40 years that people don't get. They don't get their parents' history, let alone their grandparents' history. If they get their grandparents' history, it's as, but of course I'm a grandparent, so I guess it would be their great-grandparents' history. It stops at Martin Luther King being assassinated. They all know about the Civil Rights Movement. They may read about Vietnam and the anti-war movement. But beyond that, it's like history stopped for them. And the connections to them, and the things that we built to put them in a different political place, in a different, I guess you could call it progress, in that, you know, for the most part, blacks and whites go to school together, although there's mass resegregation going on in the schools, and you can make the argument that charter schools and vouchers aid in that mass resegregation. But that whole history of after Vietnam and the things we did to try to expand democracy, they don't really have a handle on that. And so a lot of things are getting away because people, the younger people don't understand that history, and the parents aren't telling it. And in some respects, their parents are aiding in, and their grandparents are aiding in, the regression that we're seeing. Instead of us teaching these kids that we've got to fight for freedom, we've got to fight for liberation, we've got to still attack those things that, just as you mentioned, the history of genocide in this country, and the basic ideas that create the problems in this country, which is denial and ignorance, those are the things that we have to fight as progressives. And there are things that progressives believe in. It's just not a matter of Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or any of them standing up and saying, I'm a progressive. Well, what does that mean to you, Mr. President? What does that mean, Madam Secretary? To me as a progressive, it means open borders. It means respecting the humanity of Palestinians, respecting the humanity of any oppressed people, understanding our history and how we've aided bloody dictators in South America and Central America, how we've aided bloody dictators in the Middle East, how we've abused Latino workers in Mexico and the folk that migrate to this country, how we abuse black folk historically through Jim Crow, through the war on drugs, through bad lending programs, through not accepting reparations or even discussing reparations or restitution, and which has led to the attack on the only thing that's left, and that's affirmative action. And now black folk are supporting charter schools and turning a school system that should be about social mobility into something for the elite. For some reason, our children believe that they are entitled to privilege, and we've got to fight back against that.
You know what you say. What you're saying here is really fascinating, and as an educator myself, it becomes very, very difficult because I totally agree with you in terms of fighting back and pointing out, you know, history, because we do, my students have this historical amnesia. And part of the problem, as I see it, as, you know, going up against this wall, and maybe this is why it needs to be a grassroots effort, is that it's very difficult to get this information out when you're dealing with corporate media. And corporate media is what is touching a lot of the audience. And even, you know, I teach at a community college, and I mean, I realize that education is going more in the direction of the business model, the corporate model. And so, you know, and then there's the notion of radicalization. We're going to be on the lookout for radicalization. So when we're talking about in the classroom, about history, about fighting back, about standing up, about protesting, you know, is that now going to be seen as radicalization under the USA Patriot Act? There's this whole surveillance component that has become just huge, and the students don't seem to find a problem with that overall because they're so used to being on this social media. And so I guess my point is that it's very, very difficult to get out accurate information. And when you talk about the Palestinians never get a fair shake, through corporate media, never. And not even in certain kinds of schools because of the lobbying system of AIPAC and others. So it's, in terms of telling the truth and being authentic and looking at history and wanting to engage students or the population with that, it becomes difficult.
Well, I'm so glad I went to. It was a strain because I had a friend that had a tragedy, but I had made the commitment to go to Brooklyn. But a lot of the things that we're talking about, these young folks were raising it, and I mentioned the ACLU because it was a big part of my life, and it taught me a lot. And the main thing that it taught me to have an appreciation of is the Constitution. And I told the young folk, I said, when you think about it, the only thing that we really have in common in this country, that all of us have in common, is the Constitution. And I said, no question, there are problems historically with the folk that wrote it, but I said, as a theory, I said, I argue the theory. I argue the theory that privacy matters. Mm-hmm. And regardless of whether or not you've come up in an age where you've got the internet and you're all online and you have apps that can follow you everywhere and let your friends know where you're at, and you've got camera phones, and you want to film everything and make everything an event, there is such a thing as privacy and the benefit of the doubt and things like no prior restraint. And those are fundamental principles that somebody has to argue and understand, and they need to understand it before it gets too late and the whole idea of Fourth Amendment protections go out the window. And that's what we're facing. And even arguing, they were arguing for victims' rights, and I said to them, I said, victims really don't have rights. They surrender their rights to the courts, and the court system was set up to defend the rights of the accused, and for people to be in a classroom setting be questioning that whole concept. Now, all of them, they'll get out there and they'll protest the treatment of some inmates, the inmates whose cause is popular. But for the most part, it's all about revenge and all the things that progressives aren't supposed to be about. We're supposed to be about justice, not revenge. And that's why you have a criminal justice system. So I think it's getting back to teaching the basics. And I think we have to teach those I've been advocating freedom schools. Now, if it can be done in a community college setting, fine. But I think that just as Dr. King, and I'm lucky to be in South Carolina where we had the Penn Center, and Septima Clark, who's from South Carolina, who's helped set up the freedom schools with Dr. King, they would do the freedom schools here at Penn Center or at Highlander and all across the country. But I think we have to really spread that out and really start teaching people the basic fundamentals of rights and what a right is. I mean, even I haven't made many friends with taking the position that, Donald Trump and his supporters have a right to have a space that they have rented and say whatever they want to say. Now, outside in the public square, well, that's where the protests happen, but in their space, it's just like being a member of a church. If you're a member of a church, a non-church member coming up and standing in the middle of the sermon and demanding that the preacher preach another sermon, they have a right to assembly just like you have the right to assemble. And so, I'm willing to argue, debate his ideas and debate the people who are supporting him, because some of the people that are supporting him, of course, I take the position that we're all racist because that's the environment that we live in, and we can't help but participate in institutional racism and white supremacy because that's the nature of the country. But there are a lot of people, and of course there are those diehard racists that just believe that they are superior to another group. But there are a lot of people that are supporting him because they are sick of the political class and sick of this incestuous relationship between the politicians of both parties with big money, or they're upset with the fact that you have all these family dynasties, or in the case of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, as they say down south, where they went into government to do good and they've done financially very well. You know, those things are significant, and we have to recognize that some of the beef that the people that are supporting Donald Trump have is legitimate. And if Donald Trump, I haven't heard Hillary Clinton say that Bill Kristol just wants to send people off to war. All those people that supported George Bush sending our children, and I was in reserve. I wouldn't go. I got out, but I still had several relatives that did many tours of duty in Afghanistan and Iraq.
You're listening to Unspun on KKRN 88.5 FM in Bella Vista. KKRN is a community radio station and is funded by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. If you'd like to support our efforts, please go to our website at kkrn.org and click on the donate button. You are listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Pamela Spoto, local educator and advocate for peace and justice, is co-hosting with me. Our guest today is Kevin Alexander Gray, civil rights activist, author, and chronicler of Black Experience in America. Our call-in number is 337-1885-5300, area code 337-1885. We invite your questions and comments. And with that, we do have a caller. He's been waiting about 5 minutes, so I want to bring him up on the air and we'll see what he's got to say. Mauro, you're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Doug, Pamela, and Kevin, and thank you all for your work. Doug, I'm looking forward to hearing your show nationally. You know, the Black Lives Movement has taught us all, and you know, I'm a activist and involved with many groups, and everywhere I go, I'm seeing the process is changing over the last couple of years. And a lot of that is because of the gains that the Black Lives Movement has made. And my specific comment is to taking a mistake and turning it around and using it to mend. You know, it's a solution. For instance, what has happened over at KKRN, where the airing of Native American derogatory music or play acting or whatever has gone on for years. And now that the program committee and KKRN has become aware of it, which, you know, did take quite a bit of time to become aware, to turn that around and use it to mend the relationship with the Native American community, which is the very community, the traditional land of where KKRN has its station. So there's an obligation to honor its local community. But to take the mistake and instead of trying to close the door on it and say it, you know, or just not mention it, to turn it around, make a public apology and say, hey, we made a mistake, and now we would like to invite you, the Native community, to step into this door and become part of our process.
Mara, do you have a question for Kevin?
Yeah, my question was, does Kevin agree with that?
Well, how could I not agree with that? I mean, I don't agree with you in regards to Black Lives Matter, totally. And plus, and I don't know the local conflict well enough to just, you know, philosophically, I believe in reaching out to people. And, of course, I think the Progressive Coalition at its base are Native Americans and Latinos and Blacks, the people that have been traditionally been disenfranchised. I think that's the core of the progressive movement. So, you know, that's what, and of course, enlightened folk, conscious folk of any race, you know, that's where the expanding of the coalition happened. So, you know, I don't think that you ought to hide from things. I didn't have a problem with them flying the Confederate, well, I did have a problem with them flying the Confederate flag, but I don't think that we ought to be driving negative speech underground, because, you know, you really want to know what people think and feel, and you confront it when they express it. So, I mean, on the second part of what you said, I agree with. On Black Lives Matter being a movement, I don't know if I agree with that totally. because, you know, we were talking about historical amnesia earlier on, and a lot of people treat the emergence of Black Lives Matter as a brand, as it is, as highlighting something that people didn't know about, that people weren't talking about. And we've always been talking about the issues of police brutality and the war on drugs for at least a better part of the last 30 years. And you know, the idea that you challenge police departments, or you help the folk in Ferguson or wherever organize, you still have to be in there for the long haul. If you're talking about changing police practices, as I said earlier, you can't just come in and do an event or do an activity and leave. You've got to go to the meetings. You've got to participate in getting people elected. And when you're running people for office, such as that young brother, Delray McKesson, who ran in Baltimore, well, if you're going to embrace all the corporatist entities that a lot of us have been fighting because you believe that you've got to have that money because you want to play on that MSNBC corporate stage, well, go to hell. You know, and that's how I'm feeling about it. If you think that you can have a movement and it's just about young people and it's not about bridging the gaps between the generations like your parents and your grandparents weren't fighting, then, you know, you're missing it. And that's my criticism with Black Lives Matter. They become a brand. They're not institutionally ensconced in these communities.
I'd like to ask you a question because this brings up another aspect of how we deal. And I think this is fascinating because I believe that words can have power. They can perpetuate stereotypes. And on the other hand, I would be against, you know, banning books because it has a certain word in it, for example. So in terms of how we approach speech that we find offensive for example, you know, we have this conflict has been going on for some time with Washington State and the Washington Redskins, for example. And Ward Churchill has talked a lot about using language in certain kinds of ways. And in class, for example, I had a student, and she's wonderful. She's just this brilliant young Black woman, and she just graduated from law school, but she was in my class in the past, and we were talking about African-American literature. And I always talk about using certain words or not using certain words in class and why we go about doing that. And for example, I do not use the N-word in class. I don't use the N-word, period. And so I asked, so Patricia, that was her name, that is her name, and she said, you know, as a Black woman, she said, I hear the N-word when I'm in the corridors. I hear it in the cafeteria. I hear it, you know, when I'm walking across campus. I don't want to hear it in this classroom. And I think she was right on. But we had a long, that allowed us to have this really good conversation about words and the power of words. And I have an article that you wrote right here in front of me, and I think it's called What It Feels Like to Be Black in America. And would you subscribe to, I think there's a line here, it said, banning it just gives it more power. Is that your position on certain kinds of words, or could you elaborate on that? How we deal with...
Absolutely. Listen, I have 7 grandkids and 2 kids. Well, they're in their 30s. And in fact, when we had the state had the commemoration of the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, down in Charleston, of course, they had Confederate balls. I mean, this is the ideological home of the Confederacy. So they had their balls, and we organized a group and did a marathon reading of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and having that marathon reading and understanding that book and what it meant for the times and what it was trying to say, reading Uncle Tom's Cabin and leaving out the word nigger would be ridiculous. It damages the effectiveness of the literature. As it relates to the power of the word, I tell, and because I use the word, you know, I'm a Black man in America. I'm 58 years old. I grew up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I'll use the word. I won't use it in certain settings because it's inappropriate to use in certain settings. But now, and you really don't want to walk up to me and call me that, but now if you do, as I tell my kids, why would I let some stranger, why would you let some unknown white stranger call you a name that makes you lose your mind and lose your composure and maybe even risk assaulting them or hurting them where your future is damaged? Why would you give a stranger that kind of power through a word?
Yeah, excellent point. It's interesting because I think that you're very eloquent in the way you write, and I know Pamela is and very aware. And I have a different point of view because I was a linguist in the military. And so words, I know words are very powerful. But
they matter.
They do matter. In fact, I used those same words in a meeting the other day. I said words matter. And even the slightest tweak of a sentence can push it. I mean, one word, one little adverb in a sentence can push it completely in the wrong direction and slight people and harm people. And some people are very good at this.
Some people are using the word as an expression of power, and it's not an expression of affection. It's not an expression of familiarity. It's an expression of their perceived power or their of over you. Of their race power over you. So that's a big difference as opposed to two brothers on the corner.
Certainly.
Who use the word to say, I love you, even though the word means that you're damned and despised. I love you in spite of that.
Yeah. And I think often white America, and I don't know how you feel about this, are not even aware of the different gradations of pronunciation, whether there's an A, an A-H, an E-R. I mean, it becomes very, very complicated. And I want to give one other quick example. I had a basketball player, Stevie, in the past, a young black man from the Bay Area, Oakland area, and he was walking across campus with two of his friends from Oakland who had arrived on campus, and some young white student woman saw Stevie, whom she knew, and she yelled across campus, "Hey!" And she used the N-word. And I'm thinking, these two guys that were walking with Stevie said, "What are you going to do about that, man? You know, you need to do something about that." And he didn't. I mean, but the idea that a white person, totally unconscious, is that unconscious, was able, would feel comfortable shouting. I mean, that
but
goes.
You know what? But that meant that somewhere in her. In her life,
yes.
Somebody black gave her permission,
yes.
In a way, or thought that. There are white folk that are that familiar, or black folk that are familiar with them, that do allow a certain person to use that word and get away with it. And part of it is because, at some level, that person has expressed some solidarity with them. Some class solidarity with them,
yes.
That they understand.
Yes.
So I mean, I only know a couple of people, whites, that have ever used that word around me, but when they did, I can recall not flipping out with them because part of it was them, just the conversation that we're having about the power of the word,
mm-hmm.
And whether or not,
yes.
Even as friends, are you going to let that word? That word affect our friendship. You know, I'm using the word to see just how you'll respond to it, and how you'll respond to me. Are we really friends? Are we really brothers? Are we really in solidarity? Words have different meanings for different people, but I wouldn't suggest that the average person, you know, because most of the time when a white person of a certain age is using it, it is all about them being white.
We let me interrupt. We have another caller. He's been waiting on the line over 5 minutes. I wanted to bring him on. So let's do that now. And Dickie, you're on the air.
Thank you, Doug. Morning, Pamela.
Good morning.
Dr. Gray. I just think that I really appreciate your perspective, and it was easy to wait listening to such interesting conversation. My question is that I know that black voters have been tending to vote mainly for Hillary Clinton in the primaries. And I also know that there are quite a number of black intellectuals who, at least Dr. West has self-identified as in the prophetic tradition of black leadership, who have supported Bernie Sanders. And quite apart from the Sanders-Clinton conflict, I'm curious about your estimation of the impact of these intellectuals.
You put me on the spot, you know, right?
I'm glad. I hope it's a good question. I have no answer. I'm really curious.
I didn't support Bernie. I didn't support Bernie in South Carolina.
I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks,
I didn't support Bernie in South Carolina, and some of the folk with his campaign have reached out, and I do, because for the most part, the Bernie Sanders supporters in South Carolina are going to be people that I've worked with and are people that I'm going to work with. My primary criticism with Sanders going into it was, A, if you're going to organize a campaign and you're up in Vermont with your wife and four white guys sitting around the table, you ought to end the meet and start over. Because it's like baking a cake. It's been my example. It's like baking a cake and using baking powder and eggs and sticking it in the oven. Well, that ain't a cake. And you can't pull it out and put the flour in. And sometimes, well, I've managed enough presidential campaigns. That Jesse's campaign, we started in 82, and then there was the 84 campaign. But between 84 and 88, we were working. We were going around the state, going around the country, organizing and meeting people and marching with unions and marching with peace activists and marching with pro-Palestinian activists and marching with anti-apartheid activists. So you have to build that coalition. You have to ask Bernie Sanders the question, all those years you've been in the Congress, all those years you've been a self-identified progressive, where are your allies? And why haven't you built that? Because that's what you have to do. You want to talk about a revolution? Well, a revolution ain't one white man standing up saying we got a revolution. It's him doing the spade work prior to that campaign. And then when you bring in Cornel West and Adolph Reed and Danny Glover and Spike Lee, which he did in South Carolina, brought a whole bunch of men and put them on a stage and in an electorate that was majority female and an electorate that votes Democratic on the local level, and seeing Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama as being the hierarchy of that party that you just joined. Well, you know what? You might not get them. And when it comes to somebody like me, well, you know, they just kind of write me off. Well, that's just Kevin. And, you know, he's a theory man. We're never going to get him. But part of it is being true to what you say you are. If you're a progressive, be a progressive. And be it all the way down the line. And so that's, you know, I think that Bernie Sanders obviously is way more progressive than Hillary Clinton. And when you go back and look at the Clinton's record, and her husband in particular, and they say, well, you can't judge her by her husband's record, but I once recall both of them saying, buy one, get one free. Their politics have been joined at the hip.
Yeah.
So, and Hillary Clinton certainly represents everything that her husband represents. They represent the Democratic Leadership Council, which is the most conservative, was established as a conservative branch of the Democratic Party to fight off the progressive branch of the Democratic Party, which was Jesse Jackson. The fact that the model for progressive organizing in America in a presidential campaign, even though he doesn't get the credit, is Jesse Jackson's 84 and 88 campaign. So where are those people at, Senator Sanders? Now, Cornell, fine. Cornell shows up and he does big events. If you get them to speak in your event, you got to pay them. That what's grassroots about that? The only way I'm gonna hear you is I got to figure out a way to come up with a big check, unless there's cameras rolling. That's not grassroots. And I love the brother. He says a whole lot of things that I agree with. Then again, he says a whole lot of things and acts like the stereotypical black intellectual. And I got to talk and use a whole bunch of big words and sound important and ain't saying a damn thing. And when the push comes to shove, it is about what you do in the communities. It's about what you help to build communities over the long term. raise money for those grassroots organizers. Raise money for organizations in the community that actually teach the progressive principles that we claim to be about. But, you know, I'm not for TV activism.
Yeah, let me break in one more time to do our quarter till the hour little spot here. And you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Pamela Spoto, local educator and advocate for peace and justice, is co-hosting. Our guest is Kevin Gray, civil rights activist, author, chronicler in many ways, and maybe in the future we're going to understand the importance of your writing, but I think you're doing an important service there, Kevin. And he's here in the studio, or on the phone, I should say, with us, and you can call in and ask him a question at 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. And I believe Pamela had another question for you.
I do a comment and a question. I'm sitting here with Race Matters by Cornel West, and I'm looking at him, and that's one of my favorite books. And I, so I'm prefacing this, that I really, really like Cornel West and some of the things that he does say. And
It's a great book,
and especially when he talks about, you know, black sexuality, the taboo subject, things, you know, going back to historical amnesia, you know, in terms of lynchings and so forth that we were able to talk about in class, and students are just appalled because they hadn't studied that. They didn't get that. But more than that, what I want to, I have your article in front of me here, or a paragraph from your article, Soul Brother, Bill Clinton and Black Americans. And I listened very intently, well, to everything you said, but particularly when you talked about the Clintons, you know, kind of being tied. You get one for free, you know. And in this article, you say that Clinton left behind a larger prison population. We're talking about Bill Clinton here. And we have the highest incarceration rate per capita than any other country in the world. I mean, we all know this, but a lot of people don't know this. But looking at what the Clinton legacy that was of no, in my opinion, of no help to the average person, where you have an increase in incarceration rates, you have sentencing disparity, as you outlined here, you have that he successfully trumped for three strikes, and it kind of goes on and
on and on,
on and on from that. And then you have Hillary Clinton, who is supported by AIPAC. It just goes on and on. And so that brings me to Bernie Sanders, of course, whom I like a lot, and that he did pull.
I give credit where credit is due now.
Okay.
I thought what Bernie did in raising the Palestinian issue was important, and pushing Hillary Clinton was important. I really do. And my, as I said, my beef with the Sanders campaign is, well, stop calling it a revolution. They had a revolution in Cuba, you know. They had a revolution in China. Let's not call it a revolution. Let's call it the beginning of building workable, effective coalitions to change the institutional nature of the classism and the racism in our country.
Okay.
and as it relates to Cornell, what you wrote, the things that you wrote, no question, are profound. Act on it. Act on it in a way, you know, Dr. King, I went to Billy Cowell's funeral a couple of weeks ago in Memphis. Billy Cowell and Reverend Jackson were the last two people alive. Reverend now is the last person alive. They were on the steps with Dr. King.
Yes.
Well, Billy was on the balcony and Jesse was in the parking lot when Dr. King was killed. And, you know, and Dr. King was giving, when he went to work with to march with the garbage workers, you know, no one had to put a deposit down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even with Jesse, I said, Jesse gets a hard time and a lot of it's deserved, but you know, I remember marching with the woodworkers in Newberry, South Carolina, with Jesse. Nobody paid him to go out there and march with the woodworkers working at a wood-cutting plant amidst death threats. Nobody asked him to do that, or any of the other places that he's gone, the farmers out in the Midwest. Nobody, you know, those things are important. Build the coalitions. We need prophetic leadership. Prophetic leadership doesn't need secretaries and agents and contracts. that's my only criticism. Mm-hmm. Or this idea of elite leadership. You know, and my criticism with Bernie, he's gone after elite liberal or elite progressive intellectual leaders, but you know, he doesn't really, they don't have the relationship with the local people that he thinks they have. They don't have that kind of juice. You have to be out here with the folk every day and feel their pain every day. It's not, you can't be a tourist. That's all I'm saying.
Yes, and I understand that. It's a difficult, and I know Doug wants to say something here.
You go ahead, but we only have a few minutes left, so I just wanted to warn on that.
And here I thought an hour, I was working today. I said, an hour, Lord.
No. I knew you could easily fill this time slot. In fact, you probably could fill a couple if you really wanted to. And you've given us so much to think about. And I've been impressed with your writing and when you're on TV, I watched a couple of things you've been on, and you have a way of tying everything together, and I think it's great because we're missing a lot of that, not only the perspective that you're bringing, but somebody to integrate it also. I just want to thank you for being so outspoken and being the person that you are, because I think it's really important, and somewhere in history, you will have a definite spot in history, I have no doubt, because there's very few people that can say the things and have the experiences that you have and can talk with authority from those places. So I wanted to thank you for being on air with us today, and I know Pamela probably has some closing words, and then we'll have to end it.
I too want to reinforce what Doug said. And I think because I work in academia, I'm also pulled towards Bill McGibbon and Dr. West, because they have this depth of knowledge. But you're right, if there's a gap between that and the person on the street, that is what has to be bridged. And I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. And thank you for pointing that out.
Hey, listen, I appreciate y'all inviting me. When I did the Waiting for Lightning to Strike book, I told the people that published it, which was AK Press, I said, you know, what I want to do is pull together a book that people put in their back pockets, like I used to do with books like Soul on Ice or the Soledad Brothers book. Or, you know, I those are books that you could put in your back pocket, and when you needed them, you could whip it out. And so, you know, I do think that Dr. West's book is useful for that, and I'm certainly not diminishing his intellect. I think everybody, all hands on deck right now.
Yes.
I think we would agree with you, and most people that are really paying attention understand what you're saying and what you're trying to do. It's just a real service, actually, to all of America. So I want to thank you once again, and then we'll have to end it right there. And so this will be this is it. We're out of time.
Okay,
so thank
you. Well, thank y'all.
Thank you, Kevin,
thank you
for being on Unspun with us today.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, you've been listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. Our guest today has been Kevin Alexander Gray, civil rights activist, author, eloquent chronicler of Black America. I will put his show up on KKRN.org's website along with the links to his articles and books. This show will air again at 4 p.m. on Wednesday afternoon. The next week on Unspun, though, we're going to have Kathy Kresser, the local write-in candidate for Shasta County Supervisor, District 3. So tune in 9 a.m. Saturdays, and also you can tune in now at 4 p.m. on Wednesday if you miss the Saturday show. Next up, Tom Hartman on KKRN. Stay tuned.